Hello, and welcome to Sobercast. We provide AA speaker meetings and workshops in a podcast format. We are an ad-free podcast, and if you enjoy listening, please help us be self-supporting by visiting Sobercast.com, look for the donate link, and drop a dollar or two into the virtual basket. Also, if you're a member of NA or have friends that are, please tell them about our other podcast, NAPOD. NAPOD features NA speakers and workshops in the same format as Sobercast. We upload a new speaker every day, and it's easy to subscribe by searching for NAPOD, N-A-P-O-D, all one word, on any podcast player app, or go to napod.xyz if you'd like to listen online. Hope you enjoy the podcast, and have a great day.
I don't know anything good or bad about each other, see? And I don't have to tell any lies or go through any of that rigmarole. He said he had a good speech prepared for me to read, but it wasn't in big print, and I couldn't read. We're going to have to bypass that. I do know I like Tom, and I think we're all going to enjoy him, and I wish you would help me welcome him from Canada, Tom G.
Chairman, I didn't know when I came in here if I was really in an AA meeting. Everything looks so damn orderly. I went and checked the chairs over there, and they're all in a straight row. So the minute those two dudes lost their badges and we got a substitute speaker, I thought, hell, I'm in the right place. Coming from a long line of substitute speakers. I know what it's like. When the chairman calls you up on Tuesday in hysterics and starts telling you what a great friend he is, you know, how much he admires your last talk. You know right then there's something cooking. I am Tom, and I'm an alcoholic. And it's sure good to be here. It's good to be anywhere. Because there was a long time when I thought I wasn't going to be anywhere very long, you know. So I'm always glad to be here, and I'm glad to be with my people. This is the family afterward that I'm looking at and admiring and loving. God, you look nice. You just look great. And you're all warm and beautiful people. I know that because I've been down in not this area, but down in the South before, as you can tell by my accent, right? I've been practicing since Cornell first wrote to me. I told him I was going to have to get out some tapes from Dave C. and some of those people and practice my accent so he'd understand me. I was up in Greensboro one night and I said something and 19 people came up afterwards and asked me what it was I said. They couldn't understand me. So if you have that problem, all right, you know, this is the starting meeting of this conference, and it sort of sets the tone, as it were. So I want you all to be real spiritual and dignified. No loud laughing or rude noises, okay? Yeah. We're just going to have a little bit of fun, because this is a fun deal. And if it ain't fun, we get worried, because then people might not stay. If you can't enjoy it, you know, it gets too damn serious. I don't think serious and spiritual are the same thing at all. I think God has a tremendous sense of humor, and they kind of have a little story about that. You may have heard it before. I hope you have not, but if you have, all right. Seems like a little drunk died. And he went up to the pearly gates. And he got met there by a spiritual messenger with wings. So he was in the right place. And the guy around and show you what's here, you know. So he took him down a path, round a corner of some bushes, and there was a group of people standing over there, dressed in black, kind of sad-faced and glum, and they were praying and throwing dust in the air and making noises, funny noises. And the guy said, "My God, who are all those people?" He said, "Well, they belong to a certain faith, certain religion, and they're here and they're doing their thing. Don't disturb them because they think they're the only ones here." And but he says, "We'll carry on." So we went down around a corner and another beautiful little bush, and there was a group of people there, and they're carrying on. They're making funny signs in the air and counting beads, and every once in a while somebody would yell bingo, and little drunk says, "My God, who are those people?" Well, he said, "They're the Catholics, but don't disturb them because, you know, they think they're the only ones here. So we'll just carry on." And we went down a little further and around another corner, and my God, there was a group of people. Oh. They were smoking cigarettes. They were drinking coffee. They were telling dirty stories. They were laughing. They were all talking, nobody listening. And the guy says to the divine God, "My God almighty, who are those people?" He said, "Well, I really don't know, but don't worry about it. They're only here for a day at a time." Now, I don't want you to think that this is just going to be a whole bunch of jokes and all that and nothing serious, because that's not true. I came here to deliver a very serious message, and I hope you're all ready for it. Alcoholism is an illness which comprises allergy of the body and an obsession of the mind. We're obsessed with the drinking idea. And I was thinking about that this afternoon when they were telling me about this golf tournament you people got down here. Playing golf, all out playing golf, you know. I just wanted to warn you that you can get obsessed with that too, you know. It happened already to a young fellow I know. He came into the program and switched his obsession from booze to golf. Now, I know some of us switched to other things, but he switched to golf and met a cute little gal in the group, and you know what happens after 2-3 months. They announced they were getting married. And everybody felt real good for them. But he had something on his conscience, and he thought he really ought to square the deck with her. So he went to her, and he said to her, "Honey, I got a confession to make to you." She said, "What's that?" He said, "Well, I got something that I really have to, in honesty, tell you." She said, "What?" He said, "I'm a golfer." She said, "A golfer? So what?" He said, no, you don't understand. I'm a golfer." She said, "Well, what does that mean?" He said, "Well, for instance, if we were walking down the street one day and I was on my way to a golf date and a car suddenly came around the corner and ran you over, I would just have to leave you there and somebody else would call the ambulance and you'd go to the hospital, and I'm a golfer." She said, I understand. "Well," she said, "I got something I have to tell you." He said, "Oh, that's nice. What's that?" She said, "I'm a hooker." He said, "Well, let's not worry about that too much. 2-3 lessons, get your right hand over, and we'll cure that." So I want all you golfers just to relax and kind of take it easy, you know. Somebody came to me and said, "Have a drink." And being 17 years of age and a long way from home and not knowing what they were talking about, really, I said, "Sure," because I didn't want to be left out. I didn't want anybody to think that I couldn't go along and be one of the boys and, you know. The only problem was that what happened to me didn't happen to the rest of them. it produced a totally different result. When I drank it, a lot of things happened. First thing that happened was, as it went down, I heard a voice for the first time in my life that I was to hear many, many, many times later. And that voice said one word, and I got to hear that voice lots. And then, you know, that warm kind of glow and the fear and the uneasiness disappears and you start feeling one with, and suddenly that person that you were afraid of, you find yourself standing beside him with your arm around him, and you're moving and you're living and you're thinking, my God, isn't this super? I'm living. This is beautiful. But as the libations continued to come, other things happened. And pretty soon, there were loud voices and red faces and fists and anger and crying out and blood on the face and throwing up and back to the university in disgrace. Blackout. Didn't remember what took place. Don't remember yet what took place. You see. Now, that's a pretty comprehensive picture of what happens to an alcoholic. But I didn't know I was an alcoholic. I thought I just had a drink. I thought that's what happened to people when they drank. So I had a kind of a fear of drinking, and I didn't really go out and drink that terribly much immediately. Oh, every 2 or 3 months or something like that. But every time I did drink, from that moment on, was the same scenario. You know, now I don't want you to think that I never had a career as a social drinker, because that really wouldn't be fair, and I don't want to mislead anybody. I did. And I can tell you exactly how long it lasted. Some people have trouble with that, and I hear them in meetings. They say, oh, I had 10 or 12 years of fun drinking. Now, that's kind of sloppy. You know, if you're going to give facts in an AA meeting, you ought to try to give them precisely, right? This 10 or 12 business. Hell, I can be a lot more precise than that. You know, when you hear about crossing the invisible line, huh? And nobody seems to know where it is. And they don't seem to know if it's wide or narrow or where it is, or... I don't have those problems. I know exactly where that is. My social drinking career lasted from the moment I picked up that first drink and swallowed it, crossed the invisible line right here, that's where it is, and it's exactly that wide, and hit the bottom. Took 4.5 seconds. So it's not really true to say I was never a social drinker. 4.5 seconds I was. Till it hit the bottom, and then the effect was produced, and once the effect was produced, I was gone. Now, how could that happen? How could that happen to a big, handsome, good-looking, athletic, intelligent genius like me? You know? Really shouldn't, should it? But hell, it did. And I look back in my life, see, when I came to AA, and we'll get into that a little bit, but when I came to AA, I didn't know anything about alcoholism. I didn't know anything about AA. I thought AA was a place to come so they could teach you how to drink, because I did it very badly. And I thought if I came to you guys, hell, you had all the experience, didn't you? Who's got more drinking experience than a bunch of alcoholics? Nobody. So if you're going to go and learn something, you go to the experts, right? So I thought I was coming to the experts, and they'd tell me how to do it. I'd been all through that olive oil and salad oil and cream and butter and all that stuff, and it didn't work. I got just as drunk, but I got to throw up in Technicolor. Yeah. But I stayed to learn that my problem was a living problem. And boy, I don't have any trouble identifying with that. I have had trouble identifying with some drinkers because some people drink differently or drank differently than I drank. But you got to me when you got to talking about the living problem, when you got to talking about the feelings, you really got to me, because I couldn't help but identify with that. You were talking about my guts. You were talking about my belly button. That's where I live, right in here. And that's where my feelings were. And that was what what was hurting me. And that's what was causing me all the trouble. And looking back in my life, with a little help from step four, I came to see very clearly that I had always been in trouble with life. It wasn't new. That didn't start when I started drinking. It started as long back as I can remember. I always felt different. I never felt that I was in life with the rest of you people. I was on the fringe. Oh, hell, I was activity. I did everything into activity. But that somehow didn't supply the answer. I can recall when I was very young, getting into a fight with a kid. He was a little red-headed guy. We called him Slippery. His name was Aubrey. He was one of those little short guys with short arms and legs and muscles and bullet head. And he grabbed me and we got into a fight and down we went. And he had me on the ground and he was sort of pummeling me pretty good. And some other kids came along and were going to pull him off me and get him up. And they were, you know, saying, leave him alone. Don't carry on any longer like that. And I remonstrated with them and said, no way. Leave him alone. I fight my own battles. I don't need you to help me. And I stayed there I don't know how long and eventually got my way out of it. I don't know how I got out of it. But I remember that feeling, that surge that came up through my stomach and up through my windpipe and that said, to hell with them, you'll show them. I won't take this. And that stayed with me all my life. I still have it. AA don't cure everything, but it helps us live with it. Helps us live with it. All the things that happened to me when I was a kid, the rebellious nature I had with my parents, the feeling of uniqueness, I felt different from. Yeah. I knew I was different than the other kids. Oh, I got into everything, baseball and hockey, and that's what I was doing at that school when I had my first drink. I was there on an education scholarship for athletics, playing hockey. And that was a natural for me because it could vent all my violence. And I loved it. Loved playing hockey. That was great stuff, you know. But then when the drinking came into it, boy, that was different. Because that loneliness had been getting me. I don't know why a 17-year-old kid with 25 close friends playing a sport like that and being part of a team. There's unity there, and there's singleness of purpose there, and there's lots of nice-looking gals hanging around there. I don't know why a kid like that would be lonely, but I was lonely. I was lonely with people. There was something inside of me that was crying out for expression, and hell, I didn't know what that was. And then when I started drinking, it was as though I were looking for something in that bottle. Naturally, I'd look at the bottle and all that was in it was booze, and I'd drink all the booze, and that wasn't what I wanted. It never did satisfy me. And I didn't know what it was. It misled me because in the beginning, the booze put things together for me. And I'd lose a lot of those feelings. And I could start feeling one with, you know, I could almost start feeling one with my family. Boy, that was different, you know. That old man of mine that didn't understand me. That mother who laid guilt trip after guilt trip on me. You know? God, I don't know if you ever had that experience. But my mother had an absolute genius. I would come home, maybe a little late, and I would walk in the door, and she would say something like, did you have a good time? And that ain't what I would hear. I would hear, what have you been up to? What have you been doing tonight? What kind of trouble you got yourself into? What have you done to disgrace the entire family? We're not sure that you're really a member of this family anyway. You knew where you were adopted, didn't you? That's what I would hear, you know? That isn't what she said at all. But I helped her. I let her. I permitted it. I asked for it. Lay a guilt trip on me. For what reason? God, I don't know. I think I was born feeling guilty. And, of course, I was a Catholic, so I had an advantage there. Catholic religion modeled on the Jewish religion. And both those Catholics and Jews they're very big on guilt. If you don't have it, they'll supply it. They'll get it to you. They'll get it to you. You know, run to that confessional every week or two and never be satisfied that you have made a complete and utter confession. You know, you're supposed to walk out of there feeling good and feeling clean and feeling whole. Uh-uh. Not me. Oh, first two steps, yeah. And then all of a sudden I'd remember, oh, God, I forgot to say, you know. And I'd run back maybe. And a couple of times the priest would tell me, you don't need to come back here. That's a sin. That's scrupulosity. You're trying to be too damn perfect. I didn't know what he was talking about. I didn't know that I was just one of God's kids and that it's okay, that we're not going to be perfect. We weren't born perfect. We ain't going to get perfect. And it's all right. We can live and be happy. I didn't know any of those things, you see. So it wasn't difficult to see the progression of alcoholism in my life. It went on and all through a service career, and then I came back and went to university and eventually became a lawyer. Lots of opportunities to drink in the law business, I'll tell you. They know them all. You know that little saying, sober as a judge? If you believe that, I got some land down in the Everglades that I'd like to tell you. It ain't so. It's not so. Those bar associations. Now I belong to an organization that knows something about that. Got into it through you people. It's called International Lawyers in AA, and if there's any lawyers in the mob here, please come and see me afterwards. We have a recording secretary, we have a program going on all the time, and we have a convention once a year. Just had it up in New York about 3 weeks ago. It was super. We had a lot of lawyers there, some from overseas, some from South Africa, from all over the United States and Canada. And we're doing a job. We've contacted every bar association and law society on the North American continent. We're getting people sober. We're making it possible. We're not getting them sober. We're making it possible for them to get to you people so they can get sober. Because in all my experience, there isn't any other way. I've worked with a hell of a lot of programs. Social programs. Church programs. Other programs. And I don't see anything at all other than Alcoholics Anonymous that has any success with an alcoholic. Because we have the key. We got it. It was given to us. Miraculously. You're damn right, miraculously. I'm convinced totally is a divine, straight divine gift of God given to Bill up in New York City when he's lying up there in that loft, dying, coming apart at the seams, trying to write 12 steps. Didn't know he was going to write 12. They had 6 and they weren't working very good. And he needed something for alcoholics because all he had was what he'd gotten from the Oxford groupers, bless their hearts. We stole everything we have from them, but the steps. Bill gave us those. God gave us those through Bill. And Bill's lying in bed, and he's got a notepad propped up on his knee, and he's got a temperature of 104, and he's got the flu, and he's wheezing and sneezing and damn near dying, and not able to write a word. And he's praying. He's saying, please help me, God. And suddenly, I know this because Bill told me himself. I talked to him. I asked him about it. And Bill said, suddenly the pen began to write. It was as though some other hand held it. And he said, in a short space of 20, 25 minutes, I was finished. And I didn't know what I'd written. And I went back over it and found what they were. And he said, I counted them, and there were 12 of them. And the thought kind of went through my mind, significance between that and the 12 apostles. And then Bill did a very wonderful thing. He numbered them. 1, 2, 3, oh boy. Imagine if there were no numbers. Huh? What step would you be working on? Hell, you'd pick the one you like, wouldn't you? So I'm going to do that one. That looks kind of good. I like that prayer and meditation one. Doesn't seem too hard. I can do that in 30 seconds. You know? And do that one first. Because there wouldn't be any first step. So you do that one first. So we'll see how this goes. You know? Because that's sort of what happened to me when I got here. You know, my drinking hadn't been going that good. And I've been doing it for more than 20 years. And I got to the place where it was really addictive. I was hitting it pretty good. I'd been drinking for 5, 6 days. I was at that state. Depends who you're talking to. If you're talking to me, I say 5 days. If you're talking to my wife, she says 6. But you know how those gals are. They do like to exaggerate everything, don't they? And I'm in this bar, and nothing's happening. I'm drinking, and there are doubles and triples and God knows what. And nothing's happening. There's no effect anymore. And I'm getting rather downcast and a little depressed. Boy, that's when you learn to pray, isn't it? Pick up a double, and down it goes. Nothing happens. So you take another, and you kind of swallow it with deliberation. Maybe it takes 2 swallows. And then you pray. God, 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 God. Make it work. Make it work. Make it work. And it don't work. And there you are with a hole in your belly and the wind blowing through and suspended between the floor and the ceiling. And you just feel awful. And nothing's happening that's any good. So I left that bar. Went to another one. Thought maybe it might be better if I went there. And I got up there. I had some idea that there was a doctor friend of mine might come in to help me. Though I'm not sure why I thought that doctor would be able to help me. He was a veterinarian. True, so help me God, it's true. I was going to ask him, I suppose, for some medical advice. You know. Anyway, he didn't show up. And I'm sitting there and the bartender's bringing me drinks and I got 4 or 5 of them doubles in front of me and I'm drinking them. And I wasn't thinking anything. I was not praying. I wasn't asking for anything. I was just in a total hopeless state. No feeling. You know the kind of no feeling when it's frozen and you can't feel anything? I don't know if that's ever happened to you, but it happened to me on several occasions. I remember standing at the graveside of a very dear friend of mine. Felt nothing. Well, this guy was close to me. And they're going to close it in, and I'm standing looking at that thing and saying, he's gone. And I felt nothing. And I thought, what's the matter with me? I should be feeling something. But there I am sitting in that pub. And I got that glass up to about here. And something happened. I don't know what it was. All I know is that everything changed. I felt it. It was physical. Something turned over inside of me just like that. I could feel it then. I can feel it right now. There's never been a minute since that happened that I haven't been able to feel it just by thinking about it. Just by thinking about it. And I was filled with a certain knowledge from the bottom of my feet to the top of my longest hair that I was all through. I didn't have to drink anymore. I felt it go. The urge, what Silkworth calls the phenomenon of craving, was jerked out of me like the string out of an orange. I felt it go. I didn't get to AA for another 2 days. But in the meantime, I knew a guy. Rotten old character. I'd known him when he was drinking. I used to see him walking down the street with blue stubble on his face in the wintertime and a hat pulled down and old shoes and pants and a big, long, five-button overcoat. Didn't have five buttons, only had three, and a big safety pin up here, torn sleeve, torn pocket. And I heard he got sober, and I'd seen him, and he'd been sober. And his face was bright, and his eyes were shining, and he had a little straw pork pie hat on, and God, he looked good. And he looked happy, and he looked clean, and there was something about him. He had something. I don't know how to describe that, but I've seen it many times since coming here. And Ross had that. And I got in touch with him, and he came to see me. You know, it says in the book that first 12-step call, you take it easy on the guy, you don't stay more than about 30 minutes or something like that. He never read that. He stayed 9 hours. He didn't ask me if I wanted to come in. He told me, "I'm in." He says, "You're in." And he stuck around, he wore me down. I didn't have a chance to say no or yes or anything else. You know, it says in the book someplace it's not a good idea always to tell people that they're alcoholic. And you hear a lot about that in meetings, don't you? "Oh, I can't tell him he's an alcoholic." Ross never read that. He poked his stubby little finger into my wishbone and he said, "Kid, you know your trouble. You're a goddamn alcoholic." Just in case there was any doubt, you know. Well, he was my sponsor for 18 and a half years, that old guy, till he left. Ugly guy. Busted nose all over his face. We used to say to him, "Ross, why don't you get your nose fixed?" He said, "I did. It used to be over here." Oh, boy, he'd sure be happy if he was here tonight. And maybe he is. I don't know, because I still talk to him. He's been gone 5 years, but he never left me. I still talk to him. I see him in my mind's eye every day of my life, because I love that old guy. And I know he loved me. I think somewhere in our literature it's called sponsorship. I think that's what it's called. But I call it love. Because I loved that man, and I know he loved me. Talk to me, talk to my wife, talk to my kids. He had 4,000 of the worst dirty stories anybody ever heard in their entire lifetime. And I told him, I said, "Ross, when you die, I'm going to burn those damn things." And guess who's telling them now? I'm ashamed of myself. But he could walk into my house, he could tell any one of those stories in front of my wife. If I tried to talk like that in our house, she'd throw me out. As soon as Ross opened his mouth, she'd start to giggle. Thought it was funny. She didn't listen to what he said. She was laughing at him, because he was happy, joyous, and free by the efficacy of the divine grace of this program. What an example. What an example. God, that's great. That's what AA is all about, I think. See, I got into the fellowship. I went to a group, and they said, "Here's what you do. Monday night is an open meeting. Tuesday night is something else. Wednesday night is discussion, but not for you. The old members discuss, and you sit around the outside, and you listen. And in that way, you become wise. It happens to you through your ears." I got something to tell you. It don't happen through your ears. And it don't happen through what you're sitting on. There's another way to do it. And I had to find that out. God, I got into everything. I got into intergroup. I got into institutional AA, roundups, bulletins, you know, newspaper thing, and you name it, and I was into it. General service, eventually got to be the delegate. Oh, man. A big success in AA, right? Except that I was falling apart. And I started hurting, physically hurting, pain. I don't see a clock on the wall. Nobody here's got a watch. Hell, I'm in business. I don't know what time you got, but it says 8:20 on my watch. So in 10 minutes, we're going to open the meeting. And in the meantime, we're going to have a little fun. I'm not. But I promise I will not keep you more than an hour and 90 minutes, all right? Okay. Now, where was I? Hell, I can't remember what I was talking about. Somebody said that's not the first time that's happened to you either. A malady that I sometimes fall heir to, you know. I was having pain, physical pain, across my chest and here in the sternum, you know, and up and down my arm and my back and stomach, and I'm an alcoholic. And I don't know if you know this, but alcoholics don't ever have anything little. Like, I never met an alcoholic yet that had a gas pain. No. Or a headache. Or sore eyes, or, you know, no. I was having 3 heart attacks a week. Alcoholic heart attacks. You know the kind? You know. And I had a disease in the mitral valve of the heart, and I was getting a brain tumor, and I had suspected cancer of the spine. We go for big stuff, you know. We don't fool around. And I'd been through every damn clinic in town, and the doctors were giving up. They're saying, hell, there's nothing the matter with you. Finally, I ran into a doctor who happens to be a member of this program, and he said to me in a very, you know, one of those kind doctor voices, if you know a psychiatrist, I would suggest you go and see him. I said, well, you little shit. What medical school did you graduate from? I suggest you go back for a post-grad course or something you missed along the way. I'm dying. And he's telling me to go to see a skull jockey. Oh, what's with this? Anyway, being a brave, determined alcoholic, I knew a psychiatrist. I'd had him as a witness in a couple of murder trials, so I knew him good by his first name. And I thought, well, I'll kind of sneak up on the guy, you know, and just spend a little time with him and talk to him. And if he notices anything strange, maybe he'll let me know. You know, I wasn't going to go to him and say, look, am I nuts? You don't take chances like that. He might say, yeah. Anyway, I went to see Werner and had a little chat with him, and it took him exactly 10 minutes. Put his finger right on it. He said, what's wrong with you? It's called grief. You lost your father 3 months ago. And the pain you're feeling is the pain of grief, which encompasses a lot more than just feeling sorry that somebody died. That's just the start. It's all the little unresolved guilts and the little conflicts and the I should'as and we ought'as. And sound familiar to you? About the same hopeless state of mind and body in which I arrived at the fellowship. But I was busy in the fellowship. And that damn psychiatrist said to me, I thought you were a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I said, I am. I thought it showed. He said, if you are, you shouldn't be experiencing what you're experiencing. I said, what do you mean? He said, you have a program. I said, I know that. He said, you have a book. I said, I know that. Well, he said, don't you read it? And I said, of course I do. He said, don't you do it? I said, yes, I do it. Then he said, you don't do it hard enough. You don't talk to a delegate like that. So I stamped out of that room, and I was all for going home. You know, I was going to resign from AA. The hell with it. But I thought I'd stop in at my group, you know, just to check in case there was any mail for me. And I followed the good advice that's always given to us, you know. Follow the winners. Stick with the winners. Follow the winners. Well, I went to see the winners, but, you know, winners are winners, and they're busy, and they got lots of things in their life, and they don't always have time for some poor nut that's like me, that is coming apart. and don't know why. Okay. So, I've been most grateful for that ever since, that those guys didn't have time. Because when I wanted to have a meeting, they didn't want to have a meeting. They didn't have time. So it did something for me. It immediately turned me around and sent me to the losers. If there's anybody here tonight who thinks maybe in their own mind somehow that you're in this program and you're a loser, let me tell you from my own experience, because anything I say from up here has to be out of my experience. I discovered that. There is no such thing as a loser in Alcoholics Anonymous. We don't have any losers. We have some little quicker, little easier, little faster than others fall. You just do the things that my old sponsor used to tell me. Simple, simple things. Don't drink. Come back to meetings. Read the book. You'll be all right. And believe me, that's how simple it is. Those losers came with me. You know how they are, 2 months and drunk, 3 months sober and drunk, and no answers. What's the matter with me? And they're all down on themselves and depressed and mad and angry as hell. And we got a little meeting going. Seven or eight of us. Eight of us. Seven of them and me, eight dummies. And we started out with everything, all the literature and everything. And eventually that fell away, and we were left only with the big book, nothing else, just that. Big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's blue. You may have seen it. Got one in my room, didn't bring it down here tonight. Anyhow, that's where we got to. And because we didn't know what we were doing, we started at the outside cover. We didn't want to miss anything. You know, when it says Alcoholics Anonymous, the basic text of our society. So if it's a textbook, we treated it that way. We read every damn word. And what we came up with was literally, literally doing what it says in the book to do. We didn't editorialize on it. We didn't comment on it. We didn't get bright ideas about it. We just took it and did what it said. And I found out something. Oh, man. I found out something. A tremendous secret. Now, this you're going to find hard to believe. Action is the magic word. You heard that all your life. But I was into activity. I thought activity and action were the same damn thing. I thought, God, if I'm busy and I'm doing everything for AA, you know, making all these sacrifices, I just gotta get happy sobriety. Haha, no you don't. Like hell you do. I found out you can take that big book up into your closet and read it and die drunk. It happened to a friend of mine. 30 years sober. Knew that book inside out. Complacent in his AA. Stopped doing it. Stopped taking the action. See, there's a difference, a vast difference, between activity and action. Activity is just doing something. It's just being busy. Shooting pool is activity. Don't do much for an alcoholic. But action is activity with a plan. Whoa. What a word. Plan. A plan. Where's the plan? It's in the book. Just do what's in the book. And I promise you, your life will change. I will put that in writing. I will promise you miracles in writing if you will just do, literally do, what it says in the book. I don't care what the condition of your life is at this moment. I don't care how much trouble you're in. I don't care how much you're hurting. I don't care what financial problems you've got. I don't care what health problems you've got. I don't care what your trouble is. I know what your trouble is. The answer is in the book. It says so. It says there is a solution. Whew. That
That blew my mind. How could that be? My God, in my office I have a library. It's got 50,000 books in it. There isn't one of them says there is a solution. There isn't one of them says this solution will answer every problem in your life. Not one. But that wasn't what bothered me. What bothered me about that was, how could there be a solution for all these people with different problems? How could one solution fit?
Well, that question liked to drove me crazy for maybe 10 years, 8 or 10 years. And I found out why. I found out why there is a solution. One solution. Because there's only one problem. Your problem is my problem. My old sponsor, you know, his heart brimming with love. God, there were days when I was sure he hated me. He'd look at me and he'd say, "Grafton, you don't have a problem. You are a problem." And he was right. You know, I know damn well I was a problem. Because of that lousy, rotten attitude and the way I lived and the me first stuff, the me, my mind, how do I look, how do I feel, what'll people think, what'll people say. I didn't think about others, didn't think about my wife, didn't think about my kids. And my God, you know, my wife and I got 9 kids. My rotten old sponsor used to say, "You didn't drink all the time, did you?" Yeah. Anyway, we got into that and we took it real serious. And we still work at it. We've been working at it since 1968. And we're having a hell of a time. We got more fun going. We work hard at it, you know. And people say bad things about my group. And it wounds me. Disturbs me very greatly. You can see that I'm suffering from lack of sleep and lack of nourishment. Because I'm so worried about the things they say. You know, they say things like, you have to do the steps if you go to that group. And they say things like, you have to have a sponsor if you're in that group. You have to have a sponsor in the group. You can have 4 or 5 sponsors outside of the group, but you got to have one in the group. Because they want to know where you are. Things like that. Bad thing. Well, I'm happy to report to you tonight that none of those things are true. You don't have to do any of those things if you don't belong to my group. You do it your way. I'm not here to tell you how to do it. That's up to you. I'm just sharing my experience with you. This is what happened to me. This is what saved my damn life. Oh, the miracles that we have seen take place. I'm sure, like the miracles you see in your group as a result of this program. But I think we really need to work at that, you know. We said AA is not for nothing. You don't get it for nothing. There's a price, says so right in the book. Bill told us that. There's a price that has to be paid. First part of the price is destruction of self-centeredness. Now that's good news for an alcoholic, right? That's step one. And the unmanageability of the life, the way Bill puts it in the price, he says, I must go in everything to God. Well, he doesn't say God. He says the Father of Light, which I think is beautiful. What a tremendous phrase. I must go in everything to the Father of Light who presides over us all. And that's step one. So there's a price, and it's right in step one. He's not kidding anybody. And that's what we got to do, like it or not. Believe it or not. Doesn't matter if you believe it, and you don't have to like it, you know. You don't have to like step three. You just got to do it. Somebody says, well, I don't understand it. Well, it doesn't say in the book anywhere, having understood step three, we proceeded to do it. It doesn't say that. It just says, do it. The understanding will come down the road someplace. If you ever need it, I don't know what the hell you're going to do with it, you know. Because knowledge isn't... Boy, I went down that trail, let me tell you. I was totally convinced that if I had enough intellectual knowledge, I could solve all the problems in my life. So I immediately set out to become an intellectual genius. And I want you to know that tonight, as you sit there and look up at me, You are looking at an absolute gold mine of useless information. Doesn't do nothing for nobody, and it sure didn't do anything for me. Until we put action. You know, did you ever stop to think about this? If you look at the big book, you will see that chapter 6 is entitled Into Action. You notice that? If you look at the index, you'll see that we don't have a chapter that says Into Thinking. We ain't got one. You know, and if you want to have some fun, one of my crazy friends in California has fun with this. He takes that list of 20 questions, you know, and substitutes thinking for drinking. Do you require a think at a certain time each day? Does thinking lead you to lower companionship? Read it someday and read it that way. You'll have a ball. It's really fun. Because we don't let people, we don't want people thinking. I'm again thinking. Very much. I don't believe in it. I don't think it does anything good for an alcoholic. You know that slogan, think, think, think? I don't know where the blazes they got that from. It's not in the book. We only got 3 slogans in the big book, and you know those. And think, think, think ain't one of them. So we threw it out. Well, we didn't throw it out. We turned it over. And on the back of it, we wrote action, action, action. And that's the slogan we got on our wall. But that's just our group. You know, doesn't apply to your group. If you want to go think yourselves into sobriety, rot's a rook. Go ahead. Because it is not an intellectual conquest. The program of Alcoholics Anonymous is totally a spiritual experience. Experience. It's something that has to happen as the result of something you do. You've got to do it, you know. And I like to kind of tell that little story. It's crazy. I like music, and I had a car that had a quadraphonic sound system in it, and I'm driving down the street, and I hear this little band, and I know by the beat and the tempo and the what's going that it's got to be a little black band, and this little gal is singing, and oh, man, is she beautiful, and she's really singing it. And I said to myself, my God, there's the greatest AA song I ever heard in my life. I took it back to my group. It was catchy. It was simple. And they would understand it. And I told them about it. And they said, Tom, what is it? And I said, oh, I can't sing it, but here's the whole lyric to it. Do it, 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 do it. Nothing happens until you do it. You can sit and look at it all day long, and that book ain't going to save your soul. You can sit in the meeting room all night long, and those chairs aren't going to save your soul. You can listen to all the speakers you want to, and they will get you all fired up. But let me remind you what Dr. Silkworth said. Frothy emotional appeal seldom suffices. It don't do nothing for you. How many times have you heard somebody say, oh, I went to a roundup or a conference and I came home and I felt so spiritual and I was so great. It was so wonderful for 6 days. And then I felt let down. Maybe the power is letting me down. Maybe the power isn't with me anymore. Hell, that's a totally accurate diagnosis. That's exactly what happened. See? The power is always there. But am I available? Not if I'm not removing those roadblocks, those things of self that are holding the power out and blocking the power out. You know? I can't think myself past that. I have to do something that will move that self-centeredness. Of myself and by myself, I am nothing. It's the power that doeth the works. Lack of power is my dilemma. Powerlessness is alcoholism.
I don't know anything about addiction. I gave that up. Anyway, I've got a genius doctor writing a book on addiction right now. I can hardly wait. He's been going to meetings. He ain't doing too good. I'm going to get him into that other book. Save his life. If he can hear it and do it. All those wonderful things I learned were of no value to me. It was the simple things that you people showed me and said, do these things. Walk with us and see what happens in your life. If things get bad, well, quit. But if things get good, why not come along with us? And hell, they've got nothing but good. See? That old wife of mine that was... I tend to get touchy after a while. That was ready to go and take her 7 kids with her. You know? And just leave me in the lurch like that. Without any compassion at all. She's still there. And a couple years ago, she got cancer. Big C. I had 3 things happen to me just like that. Within 1 week, the whole damn world just... What's going on here? One of my dearest friends and best clients died. Like that. Right in front of me. 2 days later, something else. That I ain't going to talk about. Not for my reasons. For other people's reasons. I have to respect their anonymity. And the next thing that happened 2 days later, I came home and my wife was looking like she's crying a little, maybe. And she said, I want to talk to you. Come in the front room. I went in, sat down. She said, I've got cancer. And then it started. And you know what you go through. All the x-rays and examinations and discussions. And sadness and explaining to the family and the 2 bads and the God Almighty's and the praying and the helplessness. Thank God for this program. So she went through 3 very serious operations. Night before that first operation. Praying all afternoon, I guess, and I was going up to the hospital to see her, try to help a little if I could. And full of all kinds of brave things to say to her, you know, the things we say. And expecting that she would be distraught and depressed and need every ounce of help I could give her. She'd be crying, I knew that, and scared, and I knew that. And I got up to the room, and it wasn't like that at all. Does that ever happen to you, that you project things, you plan things, how they're going to be, and they don't turn out like that? She was sitting up in bed, and she was laughing, and she was holding the hand of another woman who was sitting on a low chair. That other woman had a 10-year-old son on the 8th floor of the hospital. My wife was on the 3rd. And that little 10-year-old kid was dying of leukemia. And the lady was crying. She had a drunk at home. Husband's drunk. Scared. Couldn't come to the hospital. Couldn't come see his kid. And she'd been up to see the boy. And the boy wanted to see his father. And my wife's smiling. And when I come in, she said, I got a job for you. Oh, God. It's so easy to be grateful for Alcoholics Anonymous. When there's action. So instead of going there and having a terribly sad and depressing and horrendous experience, I got a 12-step call. I go get that drunk husband. I bring him to the hospital. I take him to the 8th floor. I didn't want to go to the 8th floor. I know the kids that are up there. My wife was the teacher in that hospital. I was in there every week, and I see those kids. And I know why they're there. And I didn't want to go there. But he had to go. The father had to go. And I took it. Without this program. No way. No way, baby. So we went and we saw the kid. My wife got through that operation. And the second one. And the third one. And she came home. And they call her the miracle lady. Because something happened to her in that hospital. And she's okay. She was going to come here. But she was unable at the last week or so to do that. Cornelius called her. And she explained to him. She has a bit of a problem with these things anyway. For some reason or another, she finds them emotional. Isn't that amazing? She makes it great till about Saturday afternoon, and then she's in trouble. Gets to her, you know. I don't know why she'd find it like that. But thank God for a program that can take a guy like me that, you know, I was in trouble everywhere. Those kids of mine disappearing around the corner, afraid to talk to me, afraid to see me. All I saw were brown eyes disappearing around the corner. Wife couldn't talk to me, you know. And I look at my family now, and I can't believe it. We have 9 children, and we have 9 grandchildren. And every one of them is big and healthy and getting on well at whatever they're doing. A couple of my daughters are graduates of Université de Paris, the Sorbonne. I have a son who's a lawyer. I have 2 sons who are teachers. I got a good-looking daughter who just got married 10 days ago. Oh, man. And it was a celebration. It was great. What a wonderful thing. And we had coffee pot in the corner. 200 cupper. Hell, there was more AA people there than any other kind. And it was just like a conference. It was like a roundup. And that dumb son-in-law of mine gets up there and makes a speech. And makes dirty cracks about the old man. And got away with it. How do you like that? You know? Not supposed to be like that, is it? See? What I'm trying to show you is that AA is one thing. It ain't something I do in my group. I had a living problem when I came to you people. There's only one way I know how to live. And that's your way. The AA way. According to the plan of Alcoholics Anonymous, 12 steps, 12 traditions, 12 concepts of world service. Only way I know how to act for a client is to 12-step him. I 12-step every damn one of them. For what they need. See? In love. So I don't have to hate anybody or fear anybody. There's nothing to fear. What's to fear? I'm one of God's kids. What's he going to let happen to me? Nothing. Nothing bad. Because we got a working relationship. Spells it out right in the book. Tells us exactly how it works. It says you stay close to him and do his will. Do his work well and he'll look after you. Now that's the deal. So I don't have to manage my life. Don't have to run anything. See, I discovered that AA is not something that happens at my group. It does happen at my group, but not only at my group. Everything in my life is a group. Where I work is a group. Where I live is a group. My family is a group. My whole big family is a group. And that's how I live, in a group. We're in one right here, right now. Friday night meeting of Myrtle Beach group, right here. And I got one at home. And one in my office. And my clients belong to that group. Live. It's just a beautiful way to live. It's the best life I ever had. The only easy life that has ever been mine. And I got it. I know where I got it. I got it through you. From God. The source of all life. The creator and giver of life. That's a fantastic deal. And it's just a great way to live. So I know what it means in the book when it says we insist upon enjoying life. You bet. You bet. This is a busy time of the year. We got lots of AA things going on. Assemblies everywhere. And I spent some time as a trustee on the General Service Board, so some of those people still remember me, and they ask me down to their assembly to talk about service, and I'm right there. Because I love it. I'm talking about my life, you see, and they're my kids. And it fills me with so much enthusiasm to see the young people coming in AA today. Oh, my God Almighty. For years, I used to laugh about, you know, the person who suddenly woke up one morning and thought it would be a good idea to go to AA. Jumped up in the air, kicked his heels together, and said, "Goody, I'm an alcoholic. Now I get to go to AA," right? Never happened, right? It did happen. Happened to me. So I got to quit laughing about it. My neighbor has a 21-year-old daughter. Her name's Rhonda. And she was going to university. And she was taking a course called Stress. Isn't that great? Had two chapters in it about alcoholism. She read those two chapters. She went home. She phoned me. She said, "Can I see you?" I said, "Yes." She said, "I really want to talk to you." She came to the back door and she was crying. And I said, "Well, let's go for a little ride." Got in the car. We went for a ride. She's an alcoholic. She recognized it from that book. And she came to me and told me that. Now, I never told her I was an alcoholic. I never told her she was an AA. But she's played around my house for, well, since she's 4 or 5 years old. And you can't do that around my house without knowing somebody's in it, you know. Even the dog stands at attention when you say the Serenity Prayer. Yeah. No, we got an AA house, you know. And our kids know it, and everybody knows it. And she knew it. And she comes, and now she's in our group. She's 5 months sober and doing super. Well, that ain't so great, because I was at a conference about 6 weeks ago down in Moorhead, Minnesota, Fargo, Moorhead. And I met a kid there, 21 years sober, 21 years of age, 6 years sobriety. See? That's the future of Alcoholics Anonymous, not some old turkey like me. I've had my day. I'm just basking in the program. I love it to death. It's my whole life. I could be happy doing nothing else but just share it AA with anybody that wants to share it. I got nothing special to say, just my own experience, that's all. And I'll share it with anybody. Because I know what happens. See, we found out something else that was real important to us. We found out that if you waste any time fooling around with the problem, you're not going to get anywhere. Because the answer ain't in the problem. You can work at the problem all you want, and all you're doing is boosting the problem and supporting it and maintaining it. You've got to work on the answer. And then the part that really killed me was coming to the realization. The problem's in here. When I was feeling sick and hurting, you know, and maybe done something I shouldn't have done or didn't do something I should have done, and that old meat grinder would start, you know, "Old Tom, why'd you do it? Why'd you do it? Why'd you do it?" You know how that goes. The problem was in here. And our book says to us that the answer is deep within. The answer and the problem are in the same place. They're in you. When you came here, we didn't give you anything. We didn't give you a shot. We didn't give you a pill. We gave you a cup of coffee and a couple of cookies. But we didn't give you anything. You brought the problem with you. You brought the answer with you. They come together. All we did was take the wrapping off the package and say, "Here it is. Go enjoy it. Go live it." So now we know where it is. Now we can enjoy the hell out of it. Isn't that beautiful? Go live it. It's what you do in your everyday life. So if you're looking for that answer, don't bother going looking up in the mountains someplace, or maybe down in the valley, or in the cathedral, or in Jerusalem. That's not where it's at. It's in you. You have it, so you might know it and do it.
God bless you. I sure do love you, and I'm looking forward to being with you all weekend. Thank you so much. God bless you.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Sobercast is ad-free, and we'd like your help in order to keep it that way. So if you'd like to help us be self-supporting by pledging $1 or $2 a month, visit Sobercast.com and look for the donate links. Thank you very much.